but this was the first combat situation. He hadn't expected to see his fighters engaged in an actual battle during the mission, at least nothing more than facing off against some leftover old tech that was still functioning. But here they were, about to go in against a group of ships that were ravaging the fleet, killing its people. If that wasn't war, Stockton didn't know what was. His instinct was to link up with the weakest of the four columns moving in against the enemy ships. But there was no weakest. He'd handpicked almost the fleet's entire strike complement, and save for a small contingent of rookies, themselves the pick of the newest class, he had the cream of the Confederation's fighter corps with him. They didn't need his help to take on four enemy ships no bigger than small cruisers. He found himself heading toward the end grouping, the one that included the Alliance pilots. He didn't expect any problems between the now allied forces. His veterans had fought alongside the Palatians at the bottleneck, and they'd seen just how good the Alliance pilots were. But if there was any place in his powerful formation that called for his presence, it was there. The Alliance and Confederation were allies now, but their pilots had different flying styles, and the Palatians' rigid structure of honor and conduct sometimes made the fit between the two sides a bit of a rough one. Besides, he felt he owed it to Jovi Gracchus to watch over the Palatians. His thoughts often drifted to the Alliance pilot, even 2 years after her death. His recollections were painful, memories of his anger and hatred toward her clashing with the regret he now felt at her death. It was only after she was gone that he'd realize just how similar the two of them had been. Suddenly, the chatter on the comm line increased, pulling his thoughts back to the present. Stockton's eyes flashed down to the small screen on his fighter's dashboard. It took him a few seconds to realize what had happened. One of the large blue ovals representing Confederation battleships was gone. For an instant, he thought it might be Dauntless, but then his eye caught the flagship right where she belonged. She'd taken some damage, but all in all, she was still in good shape. Formidable. He concentrated his scanners to the rear, searching, but there was nothing except a heavy cloud of hard radiation where the great battleship had been. Formidable had lost containment, and her reactors had unleashed thermonuclear fury, consuming the massive vessel and everyone on it. His mind raced, trying to recall if he knew anyone on Formidable, but he couldn't come up with any names or faces. The battleship had been, one of the newest in the fleet, commissioned 6 months after the end of the war, and until today unblooded in combat. Her first battle had proven to be her last. He felt anger moving in, replacing shock. Wherever those ships were from, whoever was aboard or had sent them, there wasn't a doubt remaining nor the slightest hesitation. To Jake Stockton, they were enemies, and he only knew one way to deal with enemies. "All squadron leaders, bring your birds up to full acceleration. We're going in, and we're going in hard." Stu Weldon turned around, reaching out frantically and grabbing hold of the table as a vicious dizzy spell took him. He barely managed to stay on his feet, and he closed his eyes and stood still for a moment, taking in a few deep breaths as the sensation receded. He didn't know if the dizziness was caused by the virus or by the immense quantities of stimulants and other drugs he'd taken to keep himself functioning. None of what he'd taken had affected the disease in the slightest. He'd already tried every antiviral known to Confederation medicine on a dozen patients to no avail. But for the first time since his research had begun, he felt he was onto something, as long as he could stay conscious long enough to finish developing the treatment. The drugs he'd been taking had ravaged his body, he knew that, and they hadn't cured a single symptom of the disease the Master had called the plague. They just combated, very temporarily, the weakness the virus was creating as it battled his immune system. He opened his eyes again, taking another breath, and then he leaned forward, lowering his eyes to the high-powered microscope on the table. He could hardly see the virus specimens, even with the scope on maximum magnification. Isolating them had proven to be immensely difficult. They were tiny even by the standards of the microscopic universe, less than 1/1,000,000th the size of a typical cell. The contagion's extreme ability to penetrate most protective gear had as much to do with size as anything else. The virus's size allowed it to work its way through otherwise impermeable barriers. It also made research, and any attempts to combat it, that much harder. The Master had given him the idea he was pursuing now. He had already been analyzing the blood of the locals, trying to determine what it was that protected them from the deadly pathogen. At first he'd wondered if it was something in the native food, or some other factor that affected the people living on the planet. Then, after speaking with the Master, he realized the utter simplicity of it. There was a genetic immunity factor, one that appeared to be extremely rare, even non-existent, in those from the Rim, but perhaps more common in people living closer to the Empire's old core. Even more likely, it had been rare on this planet as well, and on all others on which the bacteriological weapon had been unleashed. But the disease had killed anyone who hadn't possessed it. Everyone living on the planet now, and possibly on countless others, was descended from those few survivors. The answer was in the blood of the locals and in their genes. He was sure of it now, and he believed he'd found it. He looked down at the small canister on the table, at the pinkish liquid inside. He'd need more blood from the locals to make enough to treat the entire landing party, but he had enough now for a test. Normally, he'd have picked the sickest of his patients or asked for volunteers, but he didn't have time for that. He was succumbing fast, and he had to keep himself going long enough to finish the job. He would take the first dose himself. He glanced at the small injector on the table. He had no idea how the shot would affect him, what side effects it might have, or even if it would kill him instantly. It went against all his medical training to move so quickly and recklessly, but there just wasn't time for more testing and analysis. Any testing and analysis. He reached down and grabbed the injector. He took a deep breath, as much to steel his courage as anything else, and then he pressed the device against his arm, feeling the strange, almost itchy sensation as several dozen micro-injectors slid into his flesh, each of them too small to cause actual pain. He felt nothing at first, at least not beyond the vague discomfort of the shot itself. He stood where he was for a moment, and then he reached down to pick up the analyzer. His hand made it about halfway to the device when the pain hit him. He cried out and doubled over, reaching out for the table, trying to grab onto something. He succeeded only in pulling over the table and dumping half the glassware on top of him as he fell. He lay there on his back, wincing from the pain. It felt like fire somewhere deep inside his body. He struggled to overcome it, to somehow get back up. He needed to examine himself, to run the analyzer, but he could hardly move. He tried to scream, but nothing came out. He just looked up at the ceiling of the small prehab structure for a few seconds. Then everything went dark. Dauntless shook hard. It was the first hit the flagship had suffered in the fight against the enemy vessels, and Baron twisted around, instinctively leaning down to the comm to call up damage control. Fritz wasn't Dauntless's chief engineer anymore, at least not officially, but as the commander of the fleet's engineering and research operation, she was still billeted on the flagship. Baron didn't have the slightest doubt she'd be in engineering by then, orders or no. He was about to tap the controls and connect to the engineering section when he heard Sonya Eaton already speaking to someone. He felt annoyed for an instant and just as quickly pushed it away, replaced with respect for his aide. She'd taken on most of Atara Travis's duties in addition to her own, and she'd managed to handle them all perfectly, even in the middle of a battle. He smiled as he realized she was speaking with Fritz. "All systems are still operational, Admiral, including the primary batteries." She turned toward him to report the instant she disconnected from Fritz. "There's some scattered burnouts and some significant damage to one of the bays, but otherwise, we got off light." Baron finished his aide's thought, even as his eyes moved to the display, to the power gauge for the main guns. The primaries were almost ready to fire again, and Baron was impatient. He knew full well that one solid hit from those enemy beams could knock out the whole system, and the entire fleet was still outside the maximum range of the secondary batteries. He didn't relish running another gauntlet through the enemy's fire to get back into range. He was still staring at the small bar charts on the display when they maxed out, and an instant later the telltale flickering of lights on the control center told him the guns had fired. And missed. He sighed softly as he watched the display update. All four of Dauntless's primaries had missed. He was accustomed to far better targeting, and his disappointment manifested as frustration. He knew it wasn't the fault of the ship or her crew. He still had most of the veterans from the old Dauntless at their posts, and he knew they were the best. No, it was the enemy's evasive maneuvers and the AI systems that ran them. The tech was better than anything his people had, and the seemingly random shifts in acceleration and vector were confounding his gunners and their targeting computers. Baron turned toward Eaton and looked as though he was going to say something. But then he just turned toward his own comm unit and slapped his hand down on the controls. "Gunnery, this is Admiral Baron. These ships are killing us with their evasive programs. Standard fire control isn't going to get the job done. Your veterans, all of you, you've been to hell and back. Adjust your targeting AIs, let your experience and your intuition help." He wasn't sure any of what he said really made sense, but he knew he had to do something, and just telling his people to do better seemed inadequate. He also knew that he was no longer the ship's commander, that he should have given his orders to Eaton and let her pass them on. This wasn't even his Dauntless. That vessel, the one into which he'd poured so much of himself, was gone, blasted to dust, a legend that would live on forever in Confederation history, but nowhere else. This was Atara Travis's ship, and Eaton was filling in for her. But he couldn't stop himself. They could pin so many stars on his shoulders that he couldn't stand without assistance, and he would still be a ship's captain at heart. And something of the old Dauntless, perhaps no more even than the spirit of the people who'd served both vessels, lived on in this new incarnation. He'd be damned if he was going to sit and watch her miss with shot after shot. He turned toward the display, his eyes moving from one icon to another. Half a dozen of his ships had some level of significant damage, and Regency and Exeter were in bad shape, not far, he was afraid, from following Formidable to a grisly end. He wasn't concerned the fleet would lose the battle, not in the end. His people simply had too much of a numerical advantage. But on any kind of even basis, an analysis of the fight ship for ship or ton for ton, there was one inescapable conclusion, and it gored at him, cut into him like a blade shoved into his gut. His people were getting crushed. Chapter 31. Confederation Intelligence Headquarters. Port Royal City, Planet Danith, Ventica 3. 315 AC. Do it. Holston's voice was cold, his eyes fixed, not a spark of mercy or pity in them. The man hesitated. He was one of Confederation Intelligence's best, an agent who'd served Holston for years, who'd shown nothing but loyalty as he was sent into one deadly situation after another. But he was clearly uncomfortable with Holston's orders. Do it, Holston repeated firmly. He was commanding his agent to do something unethical, immoral, and in the Confederation, illegal. It was an act that could send them both to the deepest, darkest prison on the Confederation's farthest and most remote frozen penal moon, for a long, long time. And Holston didn't care. The agent took a deep breath and hesitated for another few seconds, looking in Holston's general direction, but avoiding eye contact. The spymaster just stood where he was, unmoving, silent, radiating merciless intensity. Finally, the agent looked for a few more seconds toward the haggard, exhausted-looking man shackled to the metal chair, and his hands tightened on the controls in front of him. The prisoner screamed, a mournful, pathetic shriek that would have been heard for blocks around if the room hadn't been entirely soundproof. He strained at the shackles that held him to the chair, trying to shake free from the electrodes attached to his body. But Gary Holston had placed those clamps himself, and they were secure. They'd come off when the captive told him what he wanted to know, and not a second before. Holston had exceeded his authority before. He'd spied on Confederation senators and used the dirt he'd gathered to influence, blackmail, he'd even admit, them to do what he felt had to be done. But he'd never used any of that for personal gain. Everything he had done had been for the Confederation. For all the times he'd stepped over the line, Holston had always considered himself a true patriot. But this was personal. Andy's survival wasn't crucial to the Confederation. She was one of his agents, and he'd lost many people over the years. The job was a dangerous one, and she'd volunteered of her own free will. But none of that mattered, not to Holston. Not now. Lafarge, for all her past illicit activities, and the fact that she was long somewhat of an outlaw, had served the Confederation well. Her greatest contribution, a heavily classified secret only a select few knew of in detail, had arguably saved the Confederation from utter defeat. Tyler Barron had been showered with awards and acclamations for his role in destroying the Pulsar, well-deserved ones in Holston's book. But the brilliant officer wouldn't have had the slightest chance of getting through to the enemy superweapon if Andy Lafarge hadn't found the stealth generator and brought it back to Grimaldi. She deserved better than to be written off as the cost of a botched operation. Whatever it took, Holston was going to get her back, even if he had to tear Danith down brick by brick to do it. Lafarge was his friend, and that was reason enough to him, but he also felt he owed it to Tyler Barron. No one man or woman had done as much to see the Confederation through war to victory, or at least whatever version of victory the Senate's acquiescence had allowed. Holston was well aware of Baron's feelings for Andy, of the tortured on-and-off-again dance the two had done for several years now. And he knew, as unlikely as it appeared at first glance, they were perfect for each other. Eventually, they would set aside the immense baggage they both carried and do something about it. Something lasting. As long as he got Andy out. "Again," he said, coldly, his eyes fixed on the haggard man in the chair. Holston didn't take torture lightly, but he'd fought against Sector 9 long enough to understand his enemy. The Union spy agency, and they were still Sector 9 to him, whatever they'd taken to calling themselves, didn't hesitate to inflict all manner of pain and torment on its prisoners. He knew very well that more than a few of his lost agents had died in agony, interrogated for all they had to offer their enemies. And the man sitting in the chair was a Sector 9 agent. God only knew what horrors he had inflicted on his own victims. Confederation ideals were one thing, but in Holston's mind there was some kind of justice in what he was doing. Or at least he told himself that, because he had no intention of stopping until the prisoners gave him the location of every Sector 9 hideout on Daneth. The agent had paused again. Holston understood the man's reticence, but it was pissing him off nevertheless. But then he hit the switch. The prisoner screamed again, a primal howl as his body convulsed. A few seconds later, the agent flipped the switch back, and the prisoner collapsed in the chair. Tears streamed down his face, and he gasped for air, trying to say something but unable to get the words out. "Are you ready to tell me what I want to know?" Holston stepped forward and glared at the man. "Because if you don't, I will flip this switch, and my associate and I will walk out of this room and go out for lunch, maybe a few beers. You'll be a smoking black stain on the chair by the time we come back." The prisoner's terror was clear. But Holston was far from certain the torture would break the Sector 9 agent, at least in the time he had. The Union spy agency training and conditioning programs were legendary, and no one who'd served in their ranks could doubt the consequences of cooperating with the enemy, both for them if they returned home, and for their families. Holston was usually very controlled and methodical in his actions, but he could feel that slipping away. It wasn't just his determination to rescue Andy. It had been brewing longer than that. He'd watched Van Stryker and his spacers fight their way from the brink of disaster to the verge of victory, and he knew only too well the price they had paid to get there. It hadn't shocked him when the Senate ignored a century of history and naively accepted Gaston Villeneuve's peace proposal, but it had drained him of something. All the fighting, the death, the constant struggles, and the Senate had thrown it all away, virtually guaranteeing another generation of Confederation spacers and Marines would face the horrors of war. If he couldn't see the Union defeated, couldn't contain the Senate's folly, at least he could save Andy. "It's decision time, Rob." It was the first time he'd used the prisoner's name. The past hours had been an exercise in dehumanizing the captive, but now Holston was going to offer the man an escape. "You don't need to suffer like this. Help us, and I'll see that you're safe. We help our friends. Tell me where your compatriots are keeping Andy Lafarge, and I will see that you are pardoned for your crimes, allowed to emigrate to the Confederation. And I will personally see that you have a place to live and enough money to enjoy the rest of your life in peace and luxury." Holston turned toward the small console that controlled the electrical current. "Or you can get fried right here like a strip of overdone bacon." He turned and leaned forward, bringing his eyes a few centimeters from the captive's. "Make your choice." It was a gamble. If he threatened to kill the prisoner and didn't, it would drain some of the power from future threats. And if he followed through, if he electrocuted the captive, he'd lose the best potential source of intel he had to track down Andy's whereabouts. Not to mention adding murder to his list of crimes.
"I don't know."
Holston exhaled, his fists curling up in an involuntary reaction at the prisoner's stubbornness. But then the man's voice continued.
"I don't know where she is, but I know almost every safe house and hidden base we've got on Daneth."
Holston felt a smile forming on his face. He'd done it. He'd violated countless Confederation laws to break this man, become something very similar to those he'd always despised. But he would think about all that later. Right now, he needed to find Andy, before it was too late.
"Mr. Holston, my name is Walter Aguilar. I'm chief of staff to Senator Farrell."
"Yes, Mr. Aguilar. I'm afraid I am very occupied at the moment. Whatever you've come to tell me, we'll just have to wait."
Holston took a few steps past the pompous-looking official. He was wearing light body armor, and he had an assault rifle in his hand. He'd gotten what he needed from the Sector 9 agent, at least he hoped he had, and he was on his way to find Andy. The prisoner was in rough shape, but Holston was a man of his word, at least as much as a spy could be. He couldn't send the tortured agent to the main hospital in Port Royal City, of course, but he'd taken steps to make sure the man was receiving care. If the intel the agent had provided him proved to be accurate, Holston would follow through on every one of his promises. He would see that the Union spy, former Union spy, lived out his life in luxury and comfort. And if he found out the prisoner had lied to him, well, that would have another far less pleasant result.
"I'm afraid it can't wait, Mr. Holston. I have a senatorial."
"It will have to wait," Holston snapped as he turned toward a rack on the wall and grabbed a utility bag full of grenades.
"I can only imagine where you're going, armed like that in a Confederation city in time of peace, Mr. Holston, but I can assure you it stops now. I have a senatorial decree ordering you to return to Megara at once to explain your actions on Danith. You are to come with me, right?"
The bureaucrat's voice vanished to silence as Holston pulled a pistol from his belt and pointed it right between the man's eyes.
"I said it will have to wait. Make yourself comfortable. What the hell was your name again? Or don't, I don't really care. But I have something I have to do right now, so either get out of my way or I will splatter your brains on that wall."
Holston stared at the man with a withering gaze. "Do we understand each other?" Aguilar was stunned and too terrified to respond, but he did manage to nod his head slightly, something Holston was willing to take as an answer. The spy chief turned and walked toward the door, and as the gun moved from Aguilar's face, the bureaucrat recovered some small measure of his courage, and he shouted after Holston,
"Disregarding a senatorial order is a federal crime, Mr. Holston, as is pointing a weapon at an authorized representative of the Senate. In addition to the crimes you have no doubt committed here, you are in a great deal of trouble, Mr. Holston, a great deal. You will—"
Holston just ignored it all. He stepped through the door and out into the hall, waving toward the Marines lined up against the wall. He had to go find Andy, and nothing was going to stop him, not if every senator on Megara lay down in front of him and tried to block the way. He half-listened to the hack's threats for a few seconds, and then the shrill voice faded away as he made his way down the corridor to the waiting transport.
"Andy, you're a smart woman. You know we are running out of time."
Lafarge looked up at Lié, at least through the one eye that wasn't swollen shut.
"Just kill me now, you worm, because if you don't, and I get out of here, you can count on the fact that I'll find you one day and I'll kill you. Count on that."
But she knew it was empty bluster. There was no depth to it. She was spent, beaten. She'd already told him everything she knew. He just hadn't believed her. It was something that cut at her insides, in its own way even more than the pain of the torture. She'd always prided herself on being tough, resolute. Now she knew Ricard Lié had broken her, but she had nothing to give him. All she had were her crew's fake names, which she guessed they had all abandoned the instant she disappeared. She also realized just what a pro Gary Holston was, how careful and how meticulous in protecting vital data. She'd felt bursts of anger toward her friend that he hadn't told her more, given her some kind of currency to try and stop the torment. But she understood, and even in her wretched state, she approved. She'd spoken only the truth to Lié in her last statement, though. If somehow she did escape, there was no question she'd hunt Lié down. There was enough of the old Andy Lafarge left inside her that she knew there was no way the two of them could live, not after what had happened. He'd finish her, right here, or by God she'd kill him, whatever it took. Lié smiled.
"You're a hard one, Andy. Such a pity you chose the wrong side. You could have accomplished wonders with us. Still, I have to thank you. Working with somebody like you is a rare challenge, and success in such an endeavor is its own reward."
He paused.
"Now tell me what I want to know, and we can stop this. I won't insult your intelligence and tell you we can let you live, but I give you my word I will finish things with one quick shot to the head. No more pain, no more suffering. Just tell me what you know."
Andy looked back up at her tormentor, barely able to hold her head up. Her vision was blurry and being reduced down to one eye that she could open cost her any depth perception. But Lié's smile was visible enough, and it told her all she needed to know. He had won, and she had lost. She knew it, and so did he.
I told you. I don't know anything else. Gary Holston asked me to come to Danith and try to hire some prospectors to search for old tech, all secretly paid for by Confederation intelligence.
Lee shook his head. I wish I could believe you, Andy, but I'm afraid I just don't.
He turned and gestured to a white-coated man standing next to the room's sole door.
Emilio, it's time.
The man moved toward her with a large injector in his hand.
What is that?
She asked, struggling but failing to keep the fear from her voice.
It's just something to make you more cooperative. I'm afraid it's quite painful. I believe the most common description has been, I feel like my insides are on fire.
Lee shook his head.
This is what your stubbornness brings you, Andy.
Wait a minute, she said, all attempts at hiding her panic gone now. I told you, Gary Holston, he wanted me to find out more about Sector 9's operations on Danith. That's why I went to Trencher. It's why I agreed to meet you.
Lee smiled.
That's so much better, Andy, but I'm afraid still far from enough. I regret that you have forced me to use this. In addition to being rather unpleasant, I'm afraid it will leave you a blubbering imbecile, at least as the dosage I suspect we will have to use on you. I would have as soon allowed you to die with your wits still about you, but alas, you have made your choice.
He gestured to the man who started moving toward her.
Goodbye, Captain Lafarge.
She could see the white-coated man coming toward her, obscuring her view of the rest of the room, and her eyes locked on the injector, coming closer, closer. Chapter 32 75,000 kilometers from CFS Dauntless, Z-11 system, year 315 AC.
Nothing. No fighters launching, not even close-in defenses worth a damn. What's going on here?
Stockton was looking straight ahead as his squadrons closed on the enemy warships. He'd been waiting for some kind of response, a flight of interceptors, some level of point defense. But beyond a few hastily repurposed and largely ineffective light batteries, there was nothing. He felt a coldness inside, and he couldn't set aside the fear he was leading his people into some kind of trap. Memories of vicious battles passed through his thoughts, fights against massive Union fighter wings, and worse, the deadly struggles against Palatian formations during the Alliance Civil War. This enemy was more advanced than any he'd fought before, and he knew a war with them would be a holocaust like nothing he had ever seen. With all that was just too hard to believe, he discovered a weakness in their defenses so potentially devastating. The warships were moderate in size, and they didn't look like battleships or any other kind of carrier, so the lack of fighters made at least some sense. But the closer his formation got to the enemy vessels, the more it seemed they had never even seen fighters before. It didn't take more than a quick check of the fleet status readings on his screen to see how badly these four ships were hurting Admiral Barron's battleships. The fleet's primaries were firing back now, but they were having trouble targeting the wildly gyrating vessels. One of the enemy ships had taken a pair of hits, and Stockton was relieved to see that, however advanced they were, the opposing vessels were not immune to damage. The primaries had hit hard, even if their effect had been rather less than it might have been against a Union or Alliance adversary. The problem was connecting with more shots. He'd seen Dauntless manage hit percentages north of 50% in the past, even at long range, but the fleet as a whole was shooting below 10%, and to Stockton's utter astonishment, he noted that the flagship and its famed crew of gunners hadn't scored any hits at all. He watched the display, trying to follow the evasive maneuvers of the enemy ships. His targets now. It was going to be hard to connect, especially from any significant distance. But if these ships are really without close-in defenses... He toggled the comm. All squadrons, this is Raptor. We're going to toss the book in the can on this one. He didn't suppose that would be much of a surprise to many of his pilots. He'd been a maverick his entire career, and from everything he'd heard, his reputation had exaggerated his exploits considerably. These ships don't seem to have much in the way of close-in defenses, and we haven't seen so much as a single enemy fighter. So we're not going to pop off those torpedoes at long range. These ships are too fast, too maneuverable. If we want to hit them, we've got to get in close, and I mean close. His eyes were fixed on the screen as he spoke. His lead squadrons were less than 60,000 kilometers from the enemy ships, right about at the edge of long-range plasma torpedoes.
A normal attack, close to around 40,000, or even 30,000 if the squadrons were aggressive. Any more than that, and the increased losses to defensive fire would offset any gains in accuracy. But now there was no defensive fire. That meant the fighters could get a lot closer, and the torpedoes could go all the way in under power, converting to plasmas at the last instant. The enemy ships would have to evade like hell to escape the 50G thrust of the torpedoes.
I don't want a weapon launched outside of 10,000 kilometers, and anybody who holds until under 5,000, you got a drink coming to you in the officers' club on me.
There was usually some chatter on the comm line, but now it was a cacophony of pilots shouting. His people were ready, and from the sounds of things, it looked like he might be out a month's pay in drinks. He tapped his throttle, edged his vector over, maintaining his position on the outside of the formation. As usual, his bird was fitted as an interceptor, which meant it was next to useless against an enemy that had no fighters. For a moment he considered ordering his interceptor squadrons to follow the bombers in and make strafing runs, but he had over 200 of the heavy attack ships bearing down on 4 enemy vessels. If 50 plasma torpedoes apiece didn't do the job, the puny lasers on his lighter interceptors weren't going to make the difference. He hit his thrusters, decelerating sharply, holding back so he had a good vantage point as the bombing groups went in. He watched as they closed. 20,000 kilometers, 15,000. Still no enemy fighters launching. The small number of light guns firing began to hone their targeting, however, and the bombers started taking hits. 2 were down, then 6, but the attack force ignored the losses and continued to close. The lead formations crossed the 10,000-kilometer mark, and not a single ship had launched yet. Stockton felt pride in his people and for his part in organizing such an effective and capable force. The first squadrons launched at around 8,000 kilometers, and then the whole thing turned into some kind of makeshift competition, each successive wave coming in closer than the one before. 6,000, 5,000, even 4,000. Squadron launch acknowledgements echoed in his headset now, one after the other, as scores of torpedoes lurched forward from the ships carrying them and zipped toward the target ships, accelerating at 50G and matching every evasive maneuver the enemy vessels could manage. Almost every maneuver. Stockton watched in stunned silence as the 4 ships responded to the sudden threat of his bomber's barrage. They fired up their own engines, blasting away at, how is it even possible, 40G.
No, more, he thought a few seconds later, as the readings coming in matched the 50G of his torpedoes. He'd never heard of a manned ship hitting more than 20G for any sustained period, and even that was rare. The pressure of 50G acceleration would squash crew members like bugs. He'd never seen any force dampeners powerful enough to absorb even a meaningful fraction of that kind of thrust.
They are ahead of us, pretty damn far ahead from the looks of it.
He felt a chill pass down his spine. If these ships had been equipped with fighters and close-in defensive networks, he shuddered to imagine what they might have done to his wings. He watched the barrage moving forward, heading toward the now desperately evading enemy ships. The wild moves and almost impossibly complex changes in thrust and vector were indeed shaking many of the incoming projectiles. But enough were holding their target locks. Stockton almost gave an order for his last waves to launch at 8,000 kilometers and not try to close further. The lead squadron's losses had quickly ramped up. Part of it was the shorter range, he guessed, but there was another cold truth. The enemy targeting systems were adapting, and their hit ratios, even with a relatively small number of guns firing, were soaring. The fighters trying to close beyond the 5,000-kilometer mark were giving the target ships too much time to get solid locks. The losses hadn't reached the levels he'd seen in the desperate battles of the war, but they were becoming too high to ignore. Stockton had almost allowed himself to believe the fight would be a walkover, one where his forces suffered no or extremely light losses. But his bombing squadrons penetrating to the closest ranges were losing 10% or more of their number. None of that mattered, though. One glance at the status of the fleet kept him silent. The battleships engaged in the fight were taking damage, serious damage. He had to see those ships destroyed, and as quickly as possible. He watched as 3/4 of the torpedoes zipped past the enemy ships, their nav AIs unable to match the rapid evasion programs of the target vessels. But even a 25% hit rate was better than a dozen torpedoes per ship. And for all the speed and weapons power of the enemy vessels, they were not indestructible. A single hit didn't destroy one or even cripple it, but three or four were enough to knock one out of action, and none of the four could survive more than seven. By the time the last wave of torpedoes reached their targets' positions, they encountered nothing but clouds of dust and radiation.
Vanguard reports you can land Yellow Squadron, Admiral. That should account for all the fighters.
Eden snapped out her report, crisply and coolly, much like Travis had done in her years as Dauntless's first officer. Baron had dropped all pretext of sticking to the Admiral's role midway through the battle, and now he was shouting out orders the way he had for 6 years, when he'd had a captain's insignia on his collar instead of an Admiral's stars. Dauntless's Alpha Bay was in bad shape, even worse than he'd thought when the first damage assessments had come in. Several of the structural supports were severed, which was a heavy repair even in space dock, and next to impossible in deep space. It was next to impossible instead of impossible, for one reason and one alone. Anya Fritz. Fritz had shed the bonds of her own lofty rank as readily as Baron had. He suspected she was on her hands and knees even then, crawling around some access tube, hunting down a power outage or undiagnosed malfunction. Fritz was the closest thing to a magician Baron had ever seen in an engineer, but even the mighty Fritzy was making her way through unfamiliar territory. The old Dauntless had been ripped from her as it had from him, and as much as he'd loved his old ship, he had to admit no one had known the old girl better than Fritz had.
Captain Horace, on your channel, Admiral.
Baron turned and glanced over at Eden. She did remind him of Atara, in more ways than one, including how alert she looked, when he knew for sure she'd been on duty for at least 16 straight hours. He felt like he was about to fall over himself, but then he realized he probably didn't look as tired as he was either. Setting an example was part of the job, and it came almost instinctively to him. Put him through.
Admiral, you wanted to speak to me?
Baron had sent a communique to Kraken a few minutes before. The fast cruiser had suffered a hit during the battle, and the bridge crew had advised the fleet commander that the ship's captain was off the bridge, and not accessible at the moment. Baron had smiled at the nervous bridge officer's words. She sounded like she was ready to bear the brunt of some tirade he might offer in response, but instead he just left instructions for Horace to contact him as soon as he was available. Buck Horace was a cantankerous old officer, one who'd scared the daylights out of a first-year cadet by the name of Tyler Baron. He was also hands-on in a very literal sense, and Baron knew what unavailable meant. Horace was down in the bowels of Kraken's right next to his engineers, riding his damage control parties, digging around in fried circuitry, and most likely, nowhere near a comm.
Buck.
Yes. Baron paused for a few seconds, a smile slipping onto his face. Horace had been on the verge of retirement, having terrorized his final class of cadets. But the war had been at a nadir, and the Navy needed every experienced spacer it could get. Horace took a cut in grade along with the command of Kraken, one of the new fast cruisers fresh out of the shipyard, and he'd been there ever since. He'd been scheduled to hang it up once and for all when he'd asked Baron if there was a spot for him in the White Fleet, and the newly promoted Admiral jumped at the chance to get so experienced an officer in his new command.
"I don't know where these people we fought are from," Baron continued, "but they came through Point Delta, so there's a good chance that's the route to their base."
Baron knew perfectly well that any of the system's 5 transit points could lead to the enemy's home, except probably the one his fleet had entered through. But he had to make some guesses, and that seemed like a good one.
"It's certainly one way to wherever they come from."
Horace's voice was low, scratchy, even more so than Baron remembered. Baron wasn't a young, inexperienced kid anymore, all full of piss and vinegar, but neither was he as easily intimidated as he had once been. Years of war had hardened him, made him into a veteran warrior and a fleet commander. But Horace still scared him, a little.
"Those freighters will warn their people about what happened."
Baron had almost sent his ships in to destroy the enemy supply ships, but he was still clinging to some hope there was still a way to restore the peace. Perhaps letting the freighters go would send a message, one that was hopefully more effective than anything he'd managed to say earlier.
"Hell, the signals from the satellites in orbit already did that. It's a pretty good bet we'll have another force coming this way eventually, and even better wager it will have more than 4 warships with it."
Baron was guessing about everything. He had no intel, no idea at all how many of the enemy there were or what kind of forces they commanded. For all he knew, the 4 ships Stockton's fighters had destroyed were the only ones these self-proclaimed masters from the hegemony possessed. But he didn't believe that. Not for a second.
Seems like a good bet, Admiral. Our best matchup with them is fighters, for sure, especially since it looks like they may not have any of their own. Of course, there's a chance they do, and those four ships just didn't carry any. That's a possibility we have to consider. We've got to be careful about jumping to conclusions, sir.
Baron felt uncomfortable with his former teacher and superior addressing him as Admiral and Sir. He almost told Horace to call him Tyler, but it didn't seem appropriate in front of Dauntless's huge control center crew. Besides, he doubted old Ramrod Horace would have deviated a millimeter from the book as far as addressing superior officers, regardless of age or experience, even when the junior officer had been the only one to threaten the senior with a failing grade back at the academy. I agree about careless assumptions, Buck, but it sure looks like fighters are something new to them. You're right for sure. Four cruiser-sized ships simply might not have had any squadrons, even if their line ships have thousands of fighters bursting out at the seams. But I'd guess they'd damn sure have better close-in defenses if fighters were in their arsenal. Don't you think?
I do, Admiral, but I still think we need to be cautious. And even if they don't have fighters, we have no idea what their heavier ships might mount. If they're going to send a force to follow up on the one we just fought, we'd better get the hell out of here and back to warn the rest of the fleet. Or we'd better get ready for one hell of a fight.
We can't leave, Buck. We've got people down on the surface, and I can't bring them back aboard. Not until we get this epidemic under control. The line was silent for a few seconds. Baron knew what was going through the older man's head. The landing party numbered in the hundreds, as opposed to tens of thousands in the fleet, and billions in the Confederation. Finally, Horace said,
"You may have to make a tough choice at some point, Admiral."
Baron knew his old instructor was just telling him the hard truth, but he felt a rush of resentment anyway. He hated the idea of leaving any of his people behind, to almost certain death, but he couldn't imagine issuing the order and giving up on Atara. They'd fought together, risked their lives in the same deadly battles. He'd always known he could lose in her battle, but that was something different than just pulling out, running and leaving her behind. "And if we stay, do you have any suggestions?"
"Well, Admiral, if we stay, then we'd better be damned ready to fight."
"That's why I wanted to talk to you. I want you to take Kraken through Transit Point Delta, and I want you to find a good spot near the point and wait. I want to know if any enemy forces are coming, and I damn sure want to know with as much time as possible before they get here."
"Yes, Admiral."
Baron couldn't read Horace from his tone. The old officer was cold as ice, which was why Baron wanted him looking out for the enemy. There was no one whose judgment he trusted more, no officer he was sure would stay calm and focused, no matter what happened. "If you pick up anything, anything at all, you are to transit back and report. Understood?"
"Yes, understood."
"Go ahead. Get through as quickly as you can and get positioned. Dock with one of the supply ships before you transit and get an extra load of drones. I want as much information as possible on anything coming our way."
"Yes, Admiral."
"And Buck, be careful."
"Always, Admiral."
Chapter 33. CFS Dauntless. Z-11 System. Year 315 AC. "We might be able to get enough volunteers for a skeleton crew, but it would have to be one of the battleships. Nothing else is large enough for the whole landing party." Sarah Eaton sat at the opposite end of Dauntless's massive conference table, as befitted her place as second in command of the fleet. Baron looked down at the Commodore, someone he considered one of his few true friends. She was right, technically at least, but any operation to get the landing party off the surface, assuming he decided to make a run toward home before more enemy forces arrived, was more complex than it seemed at first. "We'll need volunteer pilots for the shuttles, too, and can't run the ship any longer. We'll try to cordon off sections of the vessel, attempt to effectively quarantine those from the surface. But we know almost nothing about this pathogen except that many of our people were infected despite taking significant precautions." Baron turned his head and looked down the table. He had called all his top officers together to discuss options. He knew the final decision was his, but he wanted to hear what his people thought before he made his choice. Cillian Globus had made his own opinion clear. The enemy fleet had disregarded all attempts to communicate, save for their perfunctory demand that the fleet surrender immediately. To a Palatian, that meant only one thing, and there was a single way to deal with it. He was in favor of making a stand at the planet, or perhaps even better, pushing on forward, trying to find the route to the heart of the enemy's domains. Striking like a cobra, as the Palatian had put it. Baron wasn't surprised, though it still amazed him how the prospect of battle could make a man as intelligent as Globus overlook a vast array of dangers and uncertainties in the mindless pursuit of redress for slighted honor. Baron had befriended more than one Palatian, and he'd come to respect them greatly. But they could be their own worst enemies at times.
"We have to do something, Admiral. We can't just leave them all down there."
The volume of Eaton's voice declined with each word. Baron understood. They couldn't abandon the landing party, but unless the medical teams made a major breakthrough soon, there wouldn't be any survivors on the surface to worry about. If pulling the fleet out was the right call, could he really waste valuable time and risk infecting the crews of the shuttles and the chosen quarantine ship to retrieve a group of people who would all be dead soon anyway? Part of him knew the situation on the surface was almost hopeless. He shouldn't allow it to affect his judgment. He should pull the fleet out, go back to Megara and advise the Admiralty of the new threat the fleet had found. But Atara was one of those he would have to abandon, and he wasn't there yet. Intellectually, he knew he couldn't let his feelings for her influence his decision, but he just wasn't ready to abandon his friend.
"Stripping down a battleship just reduces our combat power, and running back home doesn't solve the problem. We've got a new enemy, one that threatens not only the Confederation, but the entire Rim. If we let them see us run, we're only inviting invasion. But if we fight them here and beat them, we can gain the initiative and give them a taste of what they will face if they invade the Rim."
Globus slapped his hand down on the table as he finished his statement. Baron looked over at his friend. He doubted anyone present had the slightest question as to the Palatian's opinion on what to do. But the Alliance forces were only a small percentage of the fleet's combat power, and any decision Baron made to fight would mostly affect his Confederation spacers. Baron was about to respond, but Sonya Eaton beat him to it. "Commander Globus, I respect your point of view, and I agree on the unintended effects a withdrawal might have, especially on projecting weakness to a potential enemy. If we fight and lose, we may do more to encourage that invasion of which you speak. And we must consider another factor. The Confederation knows nothing of this threat, nor does the Alliance, or for that matter the Union or any of the other Rim nations. If we fight here and are completely destroyed, they are in danger of being attacked without warning." She was seated next to Baron, and as he turned toward her and listened to her words, he suddenly realized how much she looked and sounded like her older sister. He was shocked he'd never noticed it before. His eyes moved to the end of the table, to Sarah Eaton, and back again to Sonya before he responded. "Captain Eaton is correct. Whatever we decide to do, our top priority must be getting a warning back to Megara. If the fleet remains here to fight, we must send ships back, a strong enough force to be sure it will arrive. We cannot leave the Rim without knowledge of what we have found." A series of nods worked around the table. "At least we agree on that. As for our other course of action, I think we need to seriously consider what we might face if we remain here, and how we would fight it." Baron had a feeling he should order the fleet to bug out immediately, even at the cost of abandoning his people on the planet. But he didn't like running any more than Globus did. And while he still regretted the prospect of making another enemy, he did feel a growing rage toward these masters and their followers. He'd done everything possible to prevent hostilities, to no avail. It was always best to avoid making enemies, but he also knew sometimes there just wasn't a choice. "So if these people want to fight, I'll make sure they get one."
"Stu, can you hear me?"
Weldon looked up groggily. His head felt as though a bomb had gone off inside, and his vision was weak and blurry.
"Captain?"
Atara Travis allowed herself a tiny smile.
"Yes, Stu, it's me. You gave us quite a scare there for a while."
"What happened?"
But even as he asked, it all started to come back. The lab. The injection.
"I developed a serum from the native's blood," he said, answering his own question. "I thought it would work."
For an instant, he wondered if it had, if his loss of consciousness had simply been a side effect of the cure. But it only took a few seconds for him to realize he was still deathly ill from the disease.
"I guess I was wrong."
He leaned to the side, putting his arms out and trying to lift himself off the cot.
"Wait a minute, Stu, you're in no shape."
"There's no time, Atara."
He had to find a way to defeat the disease. He knew it was already too late. He didn't have the time to start over. Travis reached out and put her hand on his arm, helping him get to his feet.
"Dr. Charles checked you out, Stu. He says you have had a reaction to the drug, some kind of rejection. He thinks it's because of everything the natives have been through. He believes they've progressed off on some splinter of genetic development, too far from our own norms, that they've almost become a different species. Enough variation, at least, to prevent their blood from being a match for ours."
Weldon nodded his head.
Of course, that had to be it. He'd been so hopeful the serum would work. He'd been certain he had isolated the immunity factor. But his body had rejected the drug, and that had prevented proper absorption. He knew in his heart he had found the cure, but none of the landing party could take it.
I need to see Sam right away, Captain. I think he's right, and we need to find a way to get around this. We might have a cure here, if I could just find a way to get our bodies to accept it.
Travis looked down at the ground for a few seconds.
I'm sorry, Stu. Sam Charles collapsed yesterday, right after he checked you out. We managed to get him in a med pod and into a cryostasis, but he's not going to be helping you with any research.
Damn. Weldon and Charles had been good friends ever since their days at Fleet Med School, and he needed his colleague now. They'd have to try 100 different processes to find a way to strip out whatever factors were causing the rejection. He took a deep breath. There has to be a quicker way. But what?
I'm sorry to hear about Sam.
He paused for a few seconds, thinking about his friend. Then he turned and started walking slowly back toward the small structure that had served as his lab.
Are you sure you're strong enough, Stu? Maybe you should rest a little longer. Dr. Charles gave you some injections to combat the rejection, but you've been through a lot.
There's no time, Captain. If we don't make some kind of progress now, we're all done for. He paused, looking at Travis. She looked back, waiting for him to continue, but he just kept staring at her.
Are you all right, Doc?
You still don't have any symptoms?
She was taken aback by the subject change.
No, not really. I guess it takes longer in some people.
Does it? In who? As far as Weldon knew, every other member of the landing party had contracted the disease. Some were still in the early stages, while others, like Brian Rogers, were barely hanging on. The big Marine had been the first to come down with noticeable symptoms, but he was still alive, his relentless constitution refusing to quite give up. But Atar Travis seemed utterly unaffected by the disease.
Of course.
He remembered the discussion with the Master, about the survivors all being descendants of people with natural immunity to the disease. Was it possible? He looked at Travis again, reached out, put his hand to her face, feeling for any signs of fever. Then he leaned in and put his face right in front of hers, looking into her eyes for any signs of cloudiness, another early symptom. But there was nothing.
Atara, you may be the answer.
Me, are you?
No, listen to me. The entire landing party is sick. All except you. The people living here all have inherited natural immunity. That means that all other genetic lines are extinct here. But if there were people immune to the disease in the old Imperial gene pool, they should be present in our own population as well.
She looked confused for a few seconds, but then she said,
"You think I'm immune?"
Weldon nodded. "Yes, I do. It's the only explanation for why you're not sick, and a serum derived from your blood shouldn't trigger rejection in other members of the Rim population."
"My blood type is..."
"It doesn't matter, Atara. We're not doing transfusions. We're just developing a serum from your blood." He grabbed her arm, losing all concern about rank and position. "Come with me. I need a blood sample from you right now." Weldon felt like death warmed over, as though he might fall over any second. But there was something inside him that hadn't been there moments before. An energy. Hope. "Very well. We'll wait another day, and then we'll make a decision. In the meantime, I want you all to contact the ships under your command, and I mean individual talks with the captains. I want every vessel ready for battle, and also fully prepared to turn around and head home. Either on a moment's notice. We're dealing with something new and very dangerous now. I'm going to expect the very best everyone in the fleet has to offer." Baron paused, looking down at the table and rubbing his eyes for a moment. The meeting had gone on a long time, and the fatigue was catching up to him. He pulled his head up again, surprised at just how much effort it took. And he looked down at the table as those present responded with various verbal and nonverbal acknowledgments. Then he turned toward Sonya Eaton. "Captain, I want you to prepare an evac plan for the landing parties. I want it on my desk in 6 hours. It's got to be complete, and it has to be 100% reliable for containing any harmful pathogens. It's also got to be something we can execute in a few hours if I give the word." He knew he just dumped a whole lot of unreasonable on his aide, but if anyone present was up to it, he was confident it was her.
"Yes, sir, I'll see to it at once."
"Very well," Baron said, and then he leaned back in his chair, pushing against the fuzziness trying to invade his thoughts. "I need a stim when this meeting is over." He wished he'd taken one before. "Kraken is on patrol in the next system, and Captain Horace will give us a warning if any enemy forces are approaching, assuming they come from the same direction.
That will give us some hours' notice, perhaps even 1 to 2 days, depending on which point they come from into the adjacent system. Horace had conducted a rough scan as soon as Kraken had transited, and he'd sent the cruiser's cutter back to transmit the findings. They were rough and incomplete. It would take more than one ship, plus a huge number of fighters or drones, to properly survey the entire system, tentatively named Z-12, but they gave Baron something to go on. There was a transit point within half a light hour of the one leading to the Z-11 system, where the fleet still orbited the world they'd creatively dubbed Planet Zero. Kraken's scan had detected 4 other points, the furthest nearly a light day distant. It would make a big difference on the fleet's warning time, depending on the point from which enemy ships emerged into Z-12.
Very well, I think that's good for now. You've all got enough to keep busy.
A short pause, then. Jake, I'd like you to stay for a minute. Jake Stockton had been uncharacteristically silent during the meeting. Baron could see his star pilot had still not adapted to just how highly he'd risen in the chain of command. Stockton was in charge of 800 fighters, a massively powerful force under any circumstances. But against an enemy that might be vulnerable to small craft attacks, it was hard to overstate the importance of the fleet's wings.
Yes, sir, of course.
The others rose as a ragged group and moved toward the door. Baron leaned forward to the comm unit in front of him and toggled the flight control channel.
Stara, we just finished the meeting.
Understood, Admiral. I'll get the shuttles ready for launch.
Baron nodded and closed the comm line. His meeting had taken considerable effort to put together, not the least of which was requiring his key officers to shuttle over to Dauntless from their own ships. He knew they could have used the fleet comm instead, even if the variable time lag between ships would have made exchanges slow and cumbersome. But he'd always preferred face-to-face meetings, especially when the stakes were as high as they were now. He waited until the others had left, and then he turned towards Stockton.
Jake, we're still guessing on whether these masters have any kind of fighters or other small craft. There's no way to know for sure, but we've got to go with our best guess, which is they don't. We're outgunned on everything else, so if we've got an edge, we damn sure need to make the most of it.
Yes, sir. I agree.
There was something in Stockton's voice, a little bit of a hitch.
What is it, Jake?
Stockton hesitated for a few seconds.
Well, sir, those ships didn't seem to have any significant weaponry for repelling a fighter attack, but when we got in close, it...
Jake, tell me what you think, even if it's a wild guess. None of us knows what we're dealing with, and we need anything we can get.
Well, Admiral, it's just that, even with their limited armament toward the end of the fight, the effectiveness of their defenses really seemed to ramp up, almost as though...
Stockton paused again.
As though their computer, or gunners, or whatever, adapted almost instantly to the threat of our bombers.
Baron looked back at his chief pilot. Stockton's statement poked at something he'd been worried about, how the enemy ships were also able to quickly adapt to nav plans designed to evade incoming fire. Baron had studied the statistics from the battle, and there was no question, at least in his mind. The enemy's hit ratio declined significantly as each new nav plan was executed, but within half a minute it would recover to the original level. Both that fact and the situation Stockton had described suggested the enemy's AIs were substantially more powerful than the fleet's, just one more advantage the hegemony seemed to possess.
We're going to need more randomness, Jake. Abrupt changes that will make it harder for their AIs to adapt. If those ships were able to ramp up their effectiveness against your fighters with so few suitable weapons, we've got to worry if they've got other ships with heavier point defense arrays.
Baron let his voice trail off. They both knew what that would mean. Stockton nodded.
I agree, sir. I'll have to develop a series of pre-designed plans and let the AI issue them. It's the only way with a force this size. I'd never be able to keep up with 800 fighters all in real time.
That makes sense, Jake. Do it. And whatever else you think might help. Unless I'm very mistaken, we're going to be dependent on your squadron if it comes to another fight. Their heavy guns are just too powerful and long-ranged for us to match. Your people are going to have to hit them before they get into range and do some serious damage, or we're in big trouble.
I understand, Admiral. I will do my best.
That's all any of us can do, Jake, and your best is pretty damned good.
Chapter 34 Troyus City, Planet Megara, Oleus 3, Year 315 AC. Desiree Mariellis watched as two of her agents pried the top off a large crate. They were in the cavernous garage of one of the buildings she'd rented for those parts of her Enterprise that didn't fit her cover.
She had offices in Troia City's business district for her work as a lobbyist, but there were multiple fronts in her war to undermine the Confederation government. The plastic container was labeled Transport Regulators, which most definitely was not what she expected, or the six others like it, to hold. Villeneuve's message to expect the shipment had come through the Confederation's own comm networks. The transmissions originated from Plegon, a sparsely populated and unimportant world out in the periphery, but the actual messages had come from Mont-Morale. Marie Ellis had no idea how Villeneuve got the communications